It's a Saturday morning and they come around so quickly, and we're always happy to talk to Dr. Ross Walker. Good morning, Ross.
G'day, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
Mate, let's get stuck into it. Jenny wants to know. She said a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Ross discussed fizzy drinks, leaching calcium from the bones.
I did.
Does that include homemade fizzy water made with SodaStream, please?
No. We're talking about the commercial soft drinks, whether they're artificially sweetened or whether they're sugar sweetened. They have a thing in them that's called phosphoric acid. Some of the clever food companies call it food acid, so people think it might be natural and good for you. But the phosphoric acid just leaches the calcium out of the bones. And interestingly, a study showed that people who have one of these soft drinks a day, as I said, whether they're sugar sweetened or artificially sweetened, doesn't matter a damn, you increase your risk for bone fracture 7 times. So people really have to think very carefully about the sort of stuff they're putting in their mouth.
So you can keep having your soda streams, Jenny, no problem there.
Absolutely.
Rita lives in Belmont, which is local in the Newcastle area. Rita is 89 years of age. Rita says she's been dealing with Sjogren's disease for 11 years and is finding her symptoms, especially joint pain and a leg that's almost locked, getting worse. She also has trouble sleeping because of throat pain and difficulty breathing. Her doctor suggested taking pharmaceuticals like paracetamol, but it's not helping, she says. She's wondering if there's any cure or relief for her condition that you could help her with.
Yeah, sure. Sjogren's syndrome, for people who don't know what it is an autoimmune disease that is typically manifested by dry eyes and dry mouth. But it also has links to many other autoimmune features, including aches and pains and a whole lot of things that Rita's described, and potentially some lung problems as well, where you get some scarring in the base of the lungs. But over the past 10 years, there's been a revolution in medicine with all of these immunotherapies, often used for cancers, but also used for autoimmune disease. So my strong advice to Rita, and I'm with greatest respect to general practitioners, this is well out of their league. She needs a referral to a rheumatologist who's an expert in autoimmune diseases, and there are many good ones in Newcastle. And she needs a referral to this rheumatologist to see if there's any potential immunotherapies that may help in this situation, because her symptoms are just a bit beyond the typical dry eyes and dry mouth. This is getting much more significant.
Albert says, is it true that certain foods can actually help lower blood pressure, and if so, what should I be eating more of?
Yeah, it's a good question, and let me say there are 5 things people can do to keep their blood pressure low before they have to start swallowing pills. One of the first things is get rid of belly fat. So I think, look, if all my patients, Brent, lost 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 kilos, depending on how much they need to lose, I'd be twiddling my thumbs all day. We'd see blood pressures drop, we'd see cardiac risk drop, we'd see all diabetic risks drop as well. So losing abdominal fat is a very important thing, which you get by cutting back calories, cutting back carbs, and cutting back grog. Regular exercise, 3 to 5 hours of exercise per week, certainly helps in dropping your blood pressure. Avoiding sugar and salt like the plague is a really important thing for the management of high blood pressure. So most Australians have double the recommended daily intake of salt, and salt is just an absolute poison for blood pressure. So imagine salt's a bit like a sponge that just draws fluid into the vascular system and drives up your blood pressure. And look, this is mother's milk stuff that doctors talk about all the time, and you've heard me say this 1,000 times, but tragically, only 5% of the population have 2 or 3 pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables every day, which is full of potassium. And it's what the potassium does is drive down the blood pressure. So it's having the fruit and vegetables. So it's not just what you should be avoiding, it's what you should be having to control the blood pressure as well. So what I'd like is for him to Google the DASH diet, D-A-S-H. And if you Google DASH diet, you'll see all of the recommended foods. It's like a modified Mediterranean diet that's very high in potassium to help lower the blood pressure. So they're the things so just to go over those, lose the belly fat, regular exercise, avoid sugar and salt, keep your grog down, and most importantly, manage your stress as much as we can in this crazy world that we live in.
What's better, exercise or diet in lowering blood pressure?
I don't think there's one that is better, but let me say about exercise. In terms of the Walker five keys of being healthy, from the least important to the most important, number one is no addictions. Number two is sleep. Number three is nutrition. Eat less and eat more natural food. Number four, second best drug on the planet, 3 to 5 hours of exercise. And number five, happiness. Now, even if you don't lose a scrap of weight with exercise, just having a regular exercise habit by itself reduces your risk by 30%. Heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, 50% reduction in osteoporosis and depression, drops your blood pressure and you sleep better. So there's no pharmaceutical preparation known to man that comes anywhere near the power of exercise. The only thing better than exercise is happiness and stress management.
So get up off the couch and go for a walk.
Absolutely.
Belinda wants to know about the new COVID booster. She said she has read it is available or will be available shortly. Should I be getting it, even if I'm in good health and haven't had symptoms in a while?
Look, my attitude to the COVID vaccination is that the initial COVID strain, to quote the Donald, the China virus, the Wuhan strain was a very serious strain that had a 3% mortality rate. 30% of people ended up very sick in hospital, many of them on ventilators. But that was 2020. What's happened over the past 4 years, we've seen COVID, it hasn't gone, and I spoke to a fellow on the phone on the way home from work on the other day, who's a friend of mine. He was sick from COVID for about 2 weeks. So it's still knocking people around, but it's now devolved as a virus in terms of its severity to something just a little bit above the common cold. And I personally believe that if you're a fit, otherwise healthy person, so you're not very old or very sick with other problems, say, for example, Rita at the age of 89 with Sjogren's syndrome, she still probably should be keeping her COVID vaccinations up to date, or very overweight. So they're the three categories of people who copped it from COVID, the very, very, very old, the very sick, or the very fat. They're the people that should be worried about COVID. The rest of us, it's a cold or just above a common cold. And especially if you're over 70, you can go and get the antivirals as well, because there is still that concern about the potential effects of the RNA vaccines. Now, people say, oh, those RNA vaccines are dodgy. No, it's just the fact that you're taking the spike protein of COVID and making an RNA copy of that. And the spike protein of COVID is very pro-inflammatory. So you're using vaccines based on some of the earlier viruses and plus some of the newer strains as well. But it's still very pro-inflammatory. So a lot of people are having more reaction from the vaccine than they are from having a piddly dose of COVID in the categories that I'm talking about.
So John wants to know, he said, I do not have an iPad. I do not sleep with a phone, but I struggle with sleep and it's affecting my overall health. Does Dr. Ross have any tips for improving sleep quality without relying on medication?
Yeah, well look, the problem for John, just because he doesn't have an iPad or a mobile phone doesn't mean he can't suffer insomnia. And in fact, even taking electronics out of the bedroom, which I think is a great idea for all of us, 30% of people will still suffer some degree of insomnia. And for those people who don't suffer insomnia, you don't know what it's like. So my mother, for example, was a severe insomniac, and she gave me the gene, and I've given it to two of my kids. So two of my five children also struggle a bit with sleep as well. But you have to do everything you can to improve your sleep hygiene. So the advice I give everybody who struggles with sleep is, firstly, go to bed at the same time in the evening, wake up at the same time in the morning. So I'm not saying it has to be, you know, exactly 10:15 when you go to sleep at night and exactly 6:15 when you wake up in the morning, but make sure you don't go to bed one night at 9 o'clock and the next night at 11 o'clock, because you're really screwing around your biologic clock if you do that. Sleep in a cool, dark room. Try to get 7 to 8 hours of sleep per night. Get all electronics out of the bedroom. You wouldn't believe this, Brent, but some people have a television in their bedroom. Why anyone would do that is just beyond me. So the bedroom is for two things. It's for sleeping and for that wonderful activity some of us get to do before sleep. And that's all it's for and nothing else. So they're the simple things you can do. And also other things, for example, I'm a very slow metabolizer of caffeine. So if I have coffee, after about 2 or 3 o'clock, I'm just staring at the ceiling all night. Whereas I've got a friend who can have a double shot latte before he goes to bed and it doesn't affect him at all because he's a rapid metabolizer of caffeine. So make sure you're not having caffeine in any form, whether it be coffee or whether it be tea or even things like soft drinks, which we spoke about as being disgraceful for you anyhow, especially after the age of after the time of about 2 o'clock. And also don't see alcohol as a sedative. So alcohol may get you off to sleep, but it completely screws your sleeping patterns. So they're the natural things people can do. And look, and this is a bit of a minor plug for something that I do. There's a guy called Max Richter who did a CD or did a music tape called Sleep. And so I listen to that all night and it actually helps me get off to sleep. So I just put a little earphone. And just listen to it all night, and it's very, very nice and helps me sleep. Just nice music in the background.
However, as our dearly departed mate, Celeste Patterson, would say, Ross, you just don't take all electronic devices out of the bedroom, do you?
Oh, very good. Very, very good. And you sounded a bit like him as well.
Lady Gwendolyn and I have had a couple of electronic devices in the room over the years, and let me tell you, she likes them more than I do.
Can I tell you a very funny story?
Sure.
We've got very good friends who are very good friends with now the dearly departed Barry Humphries, who I think was one of the greatest comedians this country's ever produced. And we're having dinner at the Opera House one night with Lizzie Spender, his wife, and our friends. And Lizzie was saying Barry was suffered very, very severe jet lag. And Barry was about to do a day, med, and a night at the opera. So we were going to the Opera House to watch Barry perform. So I said to Lizzie, look, I've got a jet lag cure. I can fix that. And she said, oh, look, if you can help Barry, that'd be wonderful. So anyhow, we watched the day, med, and a night at the opera. It was absolutely fantastic. And then the next day I'm at home and I get this call and the call is, hello, Ross, my name is Barry. I hear you can cure jet lag. It was just one of those amazing moments in your life.
Let's talk topics. Number one, scientists are developing a way to turn fecal transplants into over-the-counter capsules by isolating helpful viruses and removing harmful ones. These capsules aim to address gut disorders like infections, obesity, and other health issues, with potential for over-the-counter availability in the future. Ross, could this bring gut health solutions to everyone in a pill form?
Absolutely, and let me say also that if people want to have a healthy gut, I mean, firstly, try to avoid antibiotics as much as you can. It's one of the reasons we have such significant gut dysbiosis in this community. But just having the 2 or 3 pieces of fruit per day, the 3 to 5 servings of vegetables per day, which tragically only 1 in 20 people do, those people have the healthiest guts because they're feeding their healthy gut bacteria healthy food. And a lot of people just don't realize this. You've got to do something for your gut. By eating the right sort of food. I just come back from Asia a few months ago where I got an award for the tribiotic that I designed. Now, I cannot mention the name on air, but the tribiotic has a pre, pro, and postbiotic in it. But when you're looking at the really heavy treatment to restore your bowel function, these fecal transplants are taking the healthy feces from young people who are the donors, and they had to initially give it via a colonoscope, which is a big deal to put someone off to sleep and put the colonoscope up the backside, of course, and infuse the fecal material through that. But so they've got these really robust capsules that have the fecal material, but people think, oh, it's just the healthy bacteria that's doing the job. But interestingly, in Russia for many years, they've used these things called bacteriophages, which are viruses that only kill bacteria. So the bacteriophages get rid of the bad bacteria and leave the healthy ones alone. So they're trying to cultivate by these techniques, not just good healthy gut bacteria in the fecal transplants, but also the bacteriophages that are going to specifically kill the bad bacteria. So we're getting to the point of not just treating gut dysbiosis, but treating obesity, diabetes, asthma, a whole lot of things with these new fecal transplants. So people won't be swallowing pills where they can taste anything. They'll be very, very thick capsules that will only dissolve down in the colon and release the bacteria and the bacteriophages into the colon.
We seem to keep talking about artificial intelligence all the time. Today we talk about artificial intelligence-powered health apps, and they can offer quick diagnosis, but many struggle with using incomplete or biased data, which can lead to mistakes and missed serious conditions. Researchers are calling for better design, oversight and transparency in health apps, as well as the use of more diverse data to improve their safety and reliability for users. Ross, could these tools become trustworthy enough to support real healthcare decisions?
Oh, absolutely, as the tools get better. But I do have a cup on my desk that says, please do not confuse your Google search with my medical degree. Because what a lot of these apps do not do is give you perspective on your illness. And the apps aren't, someone like myself who's had 45 years of medical experience, that experience allows me to know whether someone's symptoms or the complexes that they're suffering are very, very significant, or whether they're just variants of aging or variants of normal. And this is the problem with the apps. What they're saying, this is a study out of McGill University, where they're saying a lot of it is garbage in and garbage out. So if you feed the wrong information in, you're going to get the wrong information coming out. But as we get these things more refined, and as experts like myself are the people who are putting the information in, then we're going to get a much better and more robust app that will be good for everybody. And I think we'll get to the point where people will have these health apps in their pocket, which will allow them to feed in information and symptoms, and the symptoms will give them better diagnoses than they're doing at the moment.
A study suggests that vitamin K2 could help reduce the frequency, severity and duration of leg cramps that often occur at night in older adults. The results show that vitamin K2 might be a simple, effective solution. My wife will be listening. She gets bad night cramps, Ross.
Yeah, well, I've been talking for years about the extraordinary benefits of vitamin K2. So when I saw this, I was even more excited. What I didn't realise, this study is suggesting that anywhere between 50 to 60% of adults will suffer some degree of nocturnal leg cramps. And in 20% of cases, these are cause significant distress and insomnia. So vitamin K2, what it does in a dose of 180 micrograms a day, takes the calcium out of your arteries and puts it back in your bones. So you get two bangs for your buck. And we spoke about a study a couple of weeks ago, whereas vitamin K2 may even have a potential preventative effect against prostate cancer. But this particular study was just under 200 people over the age of 65, average age 72, and gave them a placebo-controlled vitamin K2 180 micrograms, so the dose I use in cardiology and for osteoporosis. 8-week trial showed a marked reduction in the severity of cramps and also the frequency of cramps. So something as harmless as vitamin K2, which I think probably everyone over the age of 50 should take anyhow, this is yet another benefit for it.
Ross, I read this particular topic with a lot of interest and was probably a little disappointed when I did further research into it. The good news. The good news is AC102. Now, AC102 is an active substance showing promise in treating sudden hearing loss and preserving hearing after cochlear implants by reducing inflammation and protecting ear cells. But the bad news is it may not be relevant for those who already have cochlear implants, as its main benefits seem to focus on preventing or treating hearing loss during or after the implant procedure. They say further studies are needed to determine if effectiveness for people like myself who have already received implants, but maybe that's further down the track. But I was just going to say this is good news for people that may suffer sudden sensory neural deafness in the future.
In the future, yeah, but it's not a retrospective study. It's not going to go for someone like you who's already lost the hearing and restore your hearing. Mind you, the good news there is they are doing some trials, especially in France, of other substances that are neurotropic substances that do restore the growth of nerves, especially in the ears. So that is going on in France at the moment, so there is some hope there. But in this particular study that was only done in animals, showed this AC102. And you always know when something's at a very early stage because it hasn't got a name. It's just got a couple of letters and a number after it. But it did show quite significant anti-inflammatory effect, protected hair cells and restored growth of auditory nerves. So It appears safe, and it appears that it does work, but they've got to do human trials, which we're not even anywhere near that. And it's not for people with established hearing loss. It's for people who present within a few days and say, I can't hear. That's the problem.
Dementia is increasing worldwide. We seem to always talk about dementia, especially Alzheimer's disease, with it affecting millions. Recent studies suggest that factors like alcohol use may accelerate the disease's progression. Additionally, research into therapies such as cognitive exercises and traditional medicine offers hope for new treatments. Cardiovascular disease was once the leading cause of death, but it's now dementia, particularly Alzheimer's. The figures that you quoted in your article, let me repeat it.
Please do.
Since 1974, heart disease-related deaths have decreased by 88%. Dementia-related deaths have increased by 843%.
Yeah, and look, one of the major reasons there is people are living longer. So the longer you live, the more risk there is for Alzheimer's disease. And the studies suggest that about 10% of people over the age of 65, well, I don't like the sound of this, have some degree of either mild cognitive impairment or even going towards Alzheimer's disease. So MCI is the initial phases of Alzheimer's, and some people just stay at the mild cognitive impairment level and don't ever get worse, but still 10% of people at age 65 plus. And once you get to 85, it's getting up to about 25 to 30%. So it is a very, very common condition that obviously affects more old people than young people. But it's a couple of interesting things I just wanted to point out. One study out of the US showed that there is a strong link between Alzheimer's disease and alcohol use disorder. So very similar set of genes do both. So it seems that people, you know, when people say, oh, granddad died of Alzheimer's disease at 80, but what they're not telling you is, oh, granddad used to have five or six wines a night as well. So that may have been a contributing factor. Now, the second component of all this is they looked at people, and this was 375 older adults, average age 72, who either had a major depressive disorder in remission and or this mild cognitive impairment. And it showed that by giving them what's called cognitive remediation, which is really brain training, and a technique called transcranial direct current stimulation, which is a little pad you put over the skull, over your frontal lobes, and send electromagnetic waves into the brain. And that was a pretty intensive study, 5 days a week for 8 weeks, and then after that some maintenance treatments for about 20 to 40 minutes every day. But both of these techniques, the cognitive remediation and the transcranial stimulation, showed a significant slowing over up to a 7-year period in people with mild cognitive impairment, so slowing of people going towards dementia. And then finally, they did a study only in mice, hasn't been done in humans. There's a particular Chinese herbal medicine called Sisyphus, which is actually used for sleep. So it's done a lot of natural sleep therapies, and this has been shown to reduce cellular aging in older mice and, in fact, improve cognitive function back to that of a similar level seen in younger mice. So testing cognitive function in mice, so they don't get there and give them an exam, but what they do is they put them in a maze and see how quickly they can get out of the maze.
That is amazing.
Yeah, so to speak.
Dr. Ross, I'll let you go. You're busy, busy, busy. So thank you for your time. We always appreciate your time on a Saturday morning. And we will catch up, same bat time, same bat channel next week.
Look forward to it, my friend.